JG2.
Number 4A.
We go on and see then that the scientists are looking then for only one logical consistent set of laws and only one logically consistent universe. Now, I'd like to show a few more points about laws and then the second half of the discussion of law to get into really the development of the history and origin of law throughout the scientific world thinking in order so we can appreciate the fact that the world hasn't always thought in concepts of laws. But before we get into that, I just want to bring out two more points that Davies makes here considering what laws are at this point. He says that on page 73 in his book under the chapter, What Are the Laws of Nature? He says, given the laws of physics, the universe can create itself. Or stated more correctly, the existence of a universe without an external first cause need no longer be regarded as conflicting with the laws of physics. This conclusion is based on the application to cosmology of quantum physics. Given the laws, the existence of the universe is not itself miraculous. This makes it seem as if the laws of physics act as the ground of being of the universe. Certainly, as far as most scientists are concerned, the bedrock of reality can be traced back to these laws. And then he says that the laws are the eternal truth upon which the universe is built. And you see, that's exactly what we see now, regardless of whether they call these laws physical or not, that Mrs. Eddy said that God was a comprehensive law of the universe that includes all laws and all science is divine. There is no physical science. Therefore, the laws governing the universe, we would say that the basic laws also, we would say, from a spiritual standpoint, are the eternal truths upon which the universe is built. And in this type of work that scientists do with reductionism, one scientist or a group of them, and I've read different articles where, you know, they're always looking for the basic building block of the universe, whether it's the atom or the quark or whatever they have come to now as the basic building block. A few of the scientists now talk about how in their method of reductionism that they've come to the point where matter has disappeared and only they find a network of relationships of laws that are the substance of the universe. So this is something that is quite fundamental to our subject, to see that the laws are the eternal truth upon which the universe is built. Then we want to look at here a few questions that he asks that are so important. He says, the concept of law is so well established in science that until recently, few scientists stopped to think about the nature and origin of these laws. Now the physicists and cosmologists have made rapid progress towards finding what they regard as the ultimate laws of the universe. Many old questions have resurfaced. And again, over and over, when we take the laws in the light of Christian science, I'll always say, do you remember what Davies said? He asked the right question when he asked, why do the laws have the form they do? We'll ask that over and over when we take the level of science itself. Why does the law on the level of science itself have the form it takes? Why does the law on the level of divine science have that specific form? Why does the law on the level of absolute Christian Science have the form that those laws take? Why do the laws on the level of Christian Science have the form that those laws take? Always remembering then that a law is a method of abstraction which, when given, covers a multitude of phenomena. Therefore, the form of the law determines the multitude of phenomena upon which it governs a specific level. And it says, do the laws exist independently of a physical universe? So now what I would like to do is to take us on the journey of the origin and history of law as it develops in world consciousness. We know that mankind hasn't always then worked from laws, and I think it's very, very important to see this development. Max has taken a very similar development with us when he worked with the structure of being and its laws back in the 1970s, showing a development of how law developed within world consciousness. And I will do the same following Davies' logic of how the origin of law develops within consciousness. Something, again, that one needs to know when we base our whole subject on the structure of being and its laws. So we take a look then at the origin of law as he gives it in and around page 74 in his book. He says that the concept of a law of nature wasn't invented. We'll see that they struggle over and over between scientists. Are laws invented by the scientists or are they discovered by the scientists? That's an academic question that is around. Naturally, we take the side that they're discovered, that they're inherent in nature. But he says that the concept of a law of nature wasn't invented by any particular philosopher or scientist, although the idea was crystallized only in the modern scientific era. Its origins go back to the dawn of history and are intimately bound up with religion. Our distant ancestors must have had a rudimentary notion of cause and effect. But although certain regularities of behavior were apparent to these early people, the vast majority of natural phenomena remain mysterious and unpredictable. And gods were invented to explain natural phenomena. Thus there were the rain god, the sun god, the tree gods, river gods, and so forth. The natural world was under the control of these unseen, powerful beings. In the age of science, it is perfectly natural to seek mechanistic explanation of things. The bowstring propels the arrow, gravity pulls the stone towards the ground. A given cause in the form of a force produce an effect. However, early cultures did not generally regard the world in this way. Some perceived nature as a battleground of conflicting forces, of gods or spirits, each with a distinct personality, where they would clash or compromise. Other cultures, especially in the East, believe that the physical world was a holistic tapestry of independent influences. Aristotle sorted the world into four sorts of causes, which he called the material cause, the formal cause, the efficient cause, and the final cause. And even armed with a fairly elaborate notion of causation, Aristotle did not properly formulate the laws of nature. He discussed the motion of material bodies, but his so-called laws of motions were just descriptions of how final causes were supposed to operate. Then Davies says, set against this way of looking at the world were the monotheistic religions, such as the Jews, who conceived of God as the law giver, God being independent of and separate from his creation, imposed laws upon the physical universe from without. At this time, nature was subject to laws by divine decree. One could still assign causes to phenomena, but the connection between cause and effect was now constrained by the laws, which were set down by God, according to the Judean concept. By contrast, we see that the Greek pantheon, with Judaism's the one God, he says, we then, when we look at the relatively sophisticated society of Greek gods, we do not find the notion of an all-powerful cosmic lawgiver. Very evident events are decided by, of course, these gods in negotiation, deception, or argument, rather than by omnipotent divine decree. Creation preceded by committee, huh? We know that, don't we? Then, according to other forms of Christianity in Islam too, he said, they adopted the view that laws are imposed upon rather than inherent in nature. However, they did this not without a struggle. Then he goes on in his history of the development of law on page 76 in his book. He says that concerning the modern concept of the laws of nature, that's relative, of course, in medieval Europe, he said the subject on the one hand, in dealing with the culture and religious influence at work in the formulation of the modern concept of laws of nature, in medieval Europe, the subject on the one hand had the Christian doctrine, as we've seen then, that they were God's laws which were manifested in nature, something we hear very strongly, of course, coming down in the Bible, and of course in Mrs. Eddy basing her revelation from mind itself, certainly telling us that God is the law of the universe, following this Judeo-Christian logic. So we have in medieval Europe, on one hand, the Christian doctrine of God's laws manifested in nature, and on the other hand, a strongly enforced concept of civil law. We certainly know that even in the Judean Christian belief, not only were God's law mandatory, but we know how Paul also, as Saul, struggled even under the civil sense of law until he could come out and be only under the laws of God. So in medieval Europe, there was this strong Christian doctrine of God's laws ruling. And also, on the other hand, there were these strong enforced concepts of civil law. He says, Davies says, these provided a fertile ground for the scientific idea of the laws of nature to emerge. Thus we find that early astronomers such as Tycho Brahe and Johannes Kepler, in deducing the laws of planetary motion, believed that in studying the orderly processes of nature, they were uncovering God's rational design. So here with these early scientists, we really begin to get that concept that laws are inherent in nature themselves. Especially with Kepler's laws of planetary motion, they see that laws can be defined as the orderly process of nature. Always pay attention when I go through this history on how laws are defined, because we'll want to see that in our work, that a law is defined here as an orderly process of nature, and that Kepler believed that he was uncovering God's rational design. So we get a blending of the scientists who always look to the religion. We know that those early scientists were very religious. So the laws of planetary motion, Kepler said, he was studying the orderly process of nature, and he was only uncovering God's rational design. And God's rational design gave us the laws of motion. Then we know that as history goes on in the 17th century with Descartes and then on to Isaac Newton. With Isaac Newton, we have again his great work furthering along this concept of the laws of motion. And then, of course, he gave birth really to the age of science on his concept of the laws of motion of gravity, of which then Einstein built on these laws of motion and gravitation. But even to Newton, he was very religious, as we know, and he had a concept of a designer who worked through fixed mathematical laws, where the universe was a magnificent machine constructed by God. So he gave God as the basis of his laws of motion. But those laws, of course, then being inherent in being, very much now a scientific concept. Then Davies goes on to say that the known laws of nature, he again will come back always asking his questions of a scientist, never taking anything really for granted as they go forward into finding out, is God the end of all explanatory chain? Is there a super law behind nature? Is there an ultimate level? He's always will query back and say, then, well, ultimately, then where do these laws of nature come from? If we don't tie them, the laws of nature as being rooted in God, as Newton did, he says, as long as the laws of nature were rooted in God, their existence was no more remarkable than that of matter, which God also created. But he says, but if divine underpinning of the laws is removed, then their existence becomes a profound mystery. He says, let's just try taking God away from a definition of laws, which Newton and some of the early scientists had God behind the laws. He says, now let's just take God away. What kind of questions would we ask? He said, if we don't rely on God, he says, then we're going to have to ask the questions, where do the laws of nature come from? Who sent the message? Who devised the code? Are the laws simply there free-floating? Or should we abandon the very notion of laws altogether as an unnecessary hangover from a religious past? This is wonderful about scientists. They're always questioning, you see. We should too. We should always question. I know Max has said over and over, you see, why he goes forward is that he builds on what he already knows, and he's always questioning. I know when he first brought out the model of being, back in the late 60s and 70s in the class, says he was always questioning the model of being on the level of science itself. Now, what is the tonality? You know, do we have the right tonality for principle? How is principle characterized on the level of science itself? Then, and how is mind characterized on the level of science itself? What ideas can we give to mind on the level of science itself? What ideas can we give to mind on the level of divine science or on absolute Christian science and Christian science? And just as we felt we had them, he'd come back again and said, now are they right? Is this right? Is the model of being really now the structure for the 7,000-year period? What is the tonality of the level of science itself? Over and over, questioning it. Whereas a young student, I want to take it as a religion and say, well, you've already said it. Now, this is a fact. Now, we built on this. Not wanting, you know, a religionist always wants to get a doctrine and make it dogma and stick to it. where a scientist will always question. And that was always the nature, I know, of what Max was doing with his work, always questioning it, purifying it, always telling us, don't put it in cement. This is what I see today. It may change, it may vary a bit, but question, question, question. So as we go on, then we will just begin to wrap up what Davy sees here. Now, he does go on then and show then that these laws of nature, as taken as regularities in nature, as Newton saw then, and we, of course, go on from Newton into Einstein. He says, building then on these scientists who saw that these laws actually were inherent in nature, whether they were from God or not, he agrees that all scientists take for granted that they are inherent in nature. He said, therefore, these laws are attempt, and gives a definition, to capture the regularities systematically. So all laws of nature, they say, are in order to capture regularities in nature systematically. He says, sometimes it is argued that they are imposed on the world by our minds in order to make sense of it. I believe this is absurd. Regularities in nature are objective mathematical fact, actually existing properties of nature. Without this assumption, science is reduced to meaningless charade. So in the history of science, we now come to a man of Davy's stature and many others who say, therefore, and this is where science has taken us today in the development of the history of laws. He says, why I believe the laws of nature are real is that they uncover new things about the world, sometimes things we never suspected. Therefore, an answer to that argument, which goes on and on always within the philosophy of a science, are laws invented or discovered? He says they're discovered, and they're discovered because they're always bringing new things that the human mind never thought of. So I believe that the laws are real, and he bases it on the fact because they are uncovering new things never suspected. And then he gives a wonderful definition that we will build on with the science of Christian Science, because in a moment we'll see this is what Mrs. Eddy also says and shows in her terms of law, and as Max has shown us when he works with laws, gives the same definition, shows that a powerful law goes beyond a description of the original phenomenon. It explains and links up with other phenomena. For example, Newton's law of gravity gives an accurate account of planetary motion, but it also explains the ocean, tides, the shape of the Earth, the motion of spacecraft. So this, then, is what we have that Max has given us in the study aid as a definition of a scientific law. If we look, then, on page 92 in the study aid, just building up an appreciation of what law is. All right, so taking what Max has given us, then, in his study aid, just quickly trying to show us how we, when we look at the model of being and law, just how a law is explained. For example, he shows us that law of gravity, wanting to show, as I said, and I want to repeat this again and again, because it's how we will look at law now, always, as we approach the subject of the universal laws of God. He says, Kepler shows that a law reduces a multitude of phenomena to their basic elements or factor. This is something that he shows in the law of gravity, and he says it defines the invariable relationship of these basic elements within the whole structure of something, and a law then governs the invariable relationship within the basic structure of something. A law is an order or relation of invariable phenomenon. So therefore, what we see is that law is a method of abstraction. It takes, as I said before, a multitude of phenomenon, as an artist does, and extracts out of that multitude of phenomena just its essence. And when it has its essence in a law, then that law again covers the multitude of phenomenon. So that's why laws are very, very simple. So following Kapler's method of reasoning, he says the scientific method of arriving at laws, which is just what we saw that Davy said, that a powerful law goes beyond a description of the original phenomena. It explains and links up with other phenomena. And he also took Newton's law of gravity, as Max has done in the study aid, and he says it gives an accurate account of the planetary motion, but it also shows the ocean, tides, the shape of the Earth, and the motion of spacecraft. So a law then is a method of abstraction that takes a multitude of phenomena and reduces it to its basic elements. And therefore it defines the invariable order or relation of those elements. So a law takes a multitude of phenomena, reduces it to its elements, and then what is most important, it shows the invariable order of the relationship of those elements. So a law shows the invariable order. An order that doesn't vary forms a law. If an order always varied, we would never get a law, would we? So a law takes, as again, to repeat, a multitude of phenomena, reduces it to its basic elements, which differ. And when you put those elements in an order, and that order is invariable, it constitutes a law. Therefore, a law is a method of economy which does more with less. Therefore, as Max shows in the study aid on page 92, that the law of gravitation is said to be one of the greatest generalizations of the human mind, and then shows how it goes together. And we'll want to remember this when we work with the science level laws. I always will ask, what are, you know, the criteria for governing the law of the science level or divine science? What are the invariable of the science level law? What are the variable of the law? And on divine science, what is the invariable of the divine science law? What are the variables? And with absolute Christian science, what are the invariables and variables of those laws? And on Christian science, what are the invariable and variables of those laws? All that will be under our discussion when we discuss the laws of being.